You are entering the Royals Podcast Network.
A show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
Belted to left field. Billy comes through tonight. Splash.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
And welcome into the Kansas City Baseball Vault. I, of course, am your host, Jeff Hur, and with me, as always, is Michael Engel. Michael, how are you doing tonight?
I am pretty good.
Good to hear. We are brought to you here at the Kansas City Baseball Vault by Kelly's Westport Inn. And in case you hadn't heard yet, which you probably should have, Kelly's is having their annual block party on May 25th, starting at 8 o'clock, and show favorite Lost Wax will be playing. They'll go on at 9:30, right, Mike? They go on stage.
Yeah, they go on at 9:30. They'll play. They're on the schedule to play till 2.
So there you go, all night long at the Westport Block Party, May 25th. Kelly's, be there. It's going to be a good time. So we've got some different topics we're going to come into today. We're starting to get to that point in the season where you start to figure some things out. You know, usually, just as a kind of a rule of thumb, and we've talked about it on this show, that 40-game mark for us here, that's one thing that we really look at and track. And this week, they're going to hit that 40 games. And they're at 37 now. So I should say, as of recording this, I'm not sure when you'll be listening to it, but as of this recording on Monday, May 12th, they're at 37 games, so who knows? Maybe by the time you listen to this, they'll be past 40. But, and that's the kind of that's more or less the cutoff there for you. Kind of know what you're going to get if somebody's going to have. I mean, it's pretty hard after a 40 game stretch. Say you're, let's pull a name out of a hat here. Say you're Mike Moustakas, and you're batting 147. Then it's going to be tough, even with 120 games left, to raise that a ton, because you've got to be, you know, not only better, but a lot better to make up for the previous 40 games. So it's always kind of been that just rule of thumb demarcation point to really gauge what you're going to get. And we're going to delve into that a little bit later. But first, we're going to talk about some, as they head towards that kind of first major milestone of the season with the quarterway point. Royals had their first West Coast swing of the season, and they played the San Diego Padres 3-game set and the Seattle Mariners on a 4-game series. They ended up going 4-3 and took 2 out of 3 from the Padres, split with the Mariners. All things considered, that was a pretty good road trip for the Royals. Their bats kind of came alive in the Padres series, and
it was like all or nothing in the Mariners series.
Yeah, they had a couple games where they kind of lit it up, and then they lost 1-0 because they just could not get anything going. So one of those type of Royals series, if you will, and for Royals fans, you probably know what we're talking about. But, Mike, what's your big takeaway from the weekend? The good offensive showing in San Diego, the up and down in Seattle, and specifically, again, as of Monday, May 12th, yesterday being Sunday, the Royals had quite a bit of an offensive show, a grand slam and a 3-run homer. That you didn't just magically switch to a Rockies podcast.
That's or the any Royals other team podcast.
In the same game. Yes, exactly. In the same game, the Royals not only hit 2 home runs, but 2 multi-run home runs. And Alcides Escobar, of all people, hits the grand slam. So, Mike, what's your big takeaway from that, from their road trip there?
Well, that Mariner series was really kind of strange. It was like a microcosm of a lot of things, because they, you know, they come out that first game and they couldn't hit anything. They weren't. I mean, I think Iwakuma, who went 8 innings and looked basically untouchable, he was the best pitcher the Royals have seen this year. Like, that's as good a pitching performance they've had against the Royals this year. And they still had a shot. And that's kind of what makes that game really, really frustrating. It was only 1-0. You know, that was the Joe Posnanski has a great column about this because he basically puts a lot of it on Ned Yost, and I think in this case it's very much warranted because that's where they had the third inning intentional walk to Robinson Cano to get Danny Duffy against a righty, and inevitably on that next at bat, the winning run scored. And in the top of the ninth, you know, after five straight balls from Fernando Rodney, the Royals lay down a sack bunt. And basically in both spots, they took just a weird tactical way of, you know, giving away any kind of momentum advantage likelihood they could have won. So really, really frustrating game there. But they come out the next day and they hit, you know, what, 16 hits and they were all singles. And end up winning just, what, 6-1? So yeah. You think you get 16 hits, you probably ought to get more than six runs, but they were all singles. And, you know, it really illustrates, A, you know, how the Royals have hit this year. Not a lot of power. I mean, they've hit a lot of doubles. A lot of guys.
Hosmer's tied for the league lead, I think, in doubles, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, and they've got two others in double digits. And just not a lot of homers. And, you know, this is it was just a weird game where you kind of, you know, at least fortunately they had a really good pitching performance from I think Jason Vargas in that game, and it, you know, worked out. And then the next night it was against Chris Young, who is just, you know, the typical journeyman type of guy. Royals couldn't hit him. Guys, it was 85-86. They couldn't hit him, and really frustrating there. They only managed to get one run. And then, you know, up and down on Sunday, Jeremy Guthrie gives up seven runs, but the bullpen really, really locked it down. I mean, from Kelvin Herrera to Lewis Coleman to Aaron Crow, Wade Davis, and Greg Holland didn't give up a single run. So they really allowed the Royals to kind of chip back into it. And like you said, you know, the two big shots from Alcides Escobar and Johnny Giovitella, I mean, the two probably least likely players to hit big home runs. So you know, but the Royals also took advantage of a lot of errors. Eric Hosmer had a couple of doubles, so it was like just this explosion of different extra base hits they were able to do, and ended up, you know, they end up coming back and winning the game after really looking like they had kind of thrown it away earlier from a really, really poor Guthrie start where he gave up three homers. So
well, it's so interesting that, I mean, I'm not making any waves by saying this. I'm not breaking any new ground. But, I mean, look how easy it is to overcome some pretty big mistakes when you can score runs. I mean, when you've got Guthrie, who doesn't have his best stuff, giving up three home runs, giving up seven runs, all this stuff, and you can get a grand slam and a three-run home. That's not going to happen every game. But, you know, all the same, when you can score some runs, you can overcome some mistakes. The problem, the reason the Royals right now have been skirting that 500 line all season is because their margin of error has been so small, they have to be so exact with everything that, I mean, when they have some of the best performances of in the league from a pitching standpoint, they can't do anything with it because their offense just can't come up with the answers. And that, you know, so it's not, again, not breaking a new ground, but it's really interesting to see that, you know, hey, look at that. You know, we can overcome a lot if we just score some runs. And part of it, again, too, is a little bit of, you know, hitting, like you said, hitting all those singles on that 16-hit game. And you've got, you know, they've been hitting a decent amount of doubles, not only Hosmer, but Butler started to get back in the swing of things, and he's hitting doubles more recently. So, you know, it comes back to what we talked about a lot last week, where with the on base thing, they need to get, you know, even with 16 singles, you think you'd have a lot of guys on base, mm-hmm. but you know, all the same, like they need to get guys on base to get them home. So it's you know, a lot of things at play here, but it's, if they just, you know, if they can score runs, they can overcome these mistakes sometimes, because they haven't been able to. When, you know, James Shields gives up one run or whatever, you know, they haven't been able to overcome that mistake because they can't even score. So, you know, that's kind of the way it goes. But that's interesting. But hopefully they'll take that momentum and they'll kind of roll with it and they can keep things going. And excuse me. And maybe Maybe Johnny Giovitella with a legit shot if Omar Infante goes on the DL, or maybe some other move happens like Mike Moustakas to AAA. You know, maybe. Who knows? Just throwing it out there. But if that happens, and you know, Gio gets a real shot, maybe he can finally get into a groove and actually hit at the major league level. You know, I've always liked Gio as a player. I thought, given his shot, he could produce. Even if he is not very good, there's still a pretty good chance he's better than Mike Moustakas, or what Mike Moustakas has given us to this point this season. You know, yeah. I mean, you think that's legit? I mean, if Gio is bad and he hits .220 with a .300 on base and a .330 slugging, I mean, that's just as good as what Moustakas has given us for the last year and a half. Am I wrong?
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty crappy low bar to have to jump over, but I mean, it's kind of like when you look at last year where Moustakas and Escobar were both really, really bad. And Moustakas didn't look that bad because he was being, you know, he could easily be compared to Alcides Escobar, who was probably the worst hitter in baseball last year. So you get to that point where, you know, you have to compare, you know, miserable to bad. Yeah, bad looks a lot better. You know, I've always been a Gio fan. You know, it's pretty easily found on record that, you know, I don't think he's always been given a fair shake. But I also think that there's enough to probably say that, no, he's probably not a major league regular. But if he can hit a little bit, you know, if he can be just above replacement as a hitter and, you know, not be a butcher on defense, I mean, that's not bad. I mean, that's, you know, going to be something where you can still have some production from there, whereas Moustakas is giving you nothing right now. And they're saying that Andy McCullough from the Star tweeted it out yesterday that there's some discussion that the Royals want to bring up a reliever. And probably by the time you hear this, this decision will have been made, but we're recording Monday night, so we don't know for sure. But that, you know, they want to bring up a reliever to put another 12-man pitching staff together, whereas they only have six relievers right now. And, you know, it could be a number of things. It could be Omar Infante to the DL with the kind of tightness in his back. Probably the simplest, but probably the least attractive option. Because then you have Moustakas and Giovitella playing on the infield. And, you know, as much as I kind of have faith in Gio with a prolonged look, it's still, you know, he's still got a lot of at-bats behind him that really kind of suggest that maybe he's not going to be able to hit. You know, maybe he is. Maybe, you know, he's hit well in Omaha. He's had a couple of good games this year, so maybe that's the difference. You know, you could send Giovitella down, I suppose, if Infante's fine, and just continue where you'd started. But yeah, then Moustakas is one of the options that was basically confirmed that they might send him to AAA with the idea of kind of giving him a jump start, giving him an opportunity to go to a level where they expect him to have a lot of success, get his confidence back, where he's able to work on things with a lot less pressure than he has right now. Because I could imagine, you know, according to McCullough in a chat today, I mean, Moustakas is getting in early for reps in the cage. He's working hard. And, you know, that's all you can ask of him for right now. But at a certain point, you do have to have those results. And he is not providing them other than basically a week where he hit four home runs. And beyond that, you know, he hasn't really done anything. So, I think there's a really, really good chance that Moustakas gets sent down. And Giovitella will play third base for at least a stretch while Moustakas kind of gets his feet back under him.
Yeah, I think there's a couple ways that you can look at this. And there is as legitimate a reason as you could possibly have to send Mike Moustakas down to the minor leagues, because he's hitting .147 as of today, Monday, May 12th. He is... he's had years where, I mean, his highest batting average is in his career is what, 260? I'm sorry, I should have that in front of me, but I'm gonna pull it up really quick.
I don't even know if it's at that level.
I think it's like 242, I want to say, but I wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt just in case I was wrong. But got it up here in a second. So his Yeah, in 2011, he hit 263 in 89 games. So in full season baseball, his best career average is 242. Best on-base percentage is 296. Okay, this is a guy who's supposed to be a cornerstone of your offense. Now, so the evidence is there that he needs a look in the minors. I mean, if you go back and you break down Alex Gordon's stats before he got sent down to the minors for his big retooling where he learned a different position, they were better than that.
A lot better.
Considerably better than that. And he never, as far as I can recollect, he never had a stretch quite as bad as Moustakas is having now. I know he got off to, there was one year, I think I want to say like 2010, where he got off to a pretty bad start, but I don't know about this bad.
And it wasn't this bad. And the thing with Gordon, I mean, 2007, he wasn't good. He came up, you know, opening day, bases loaded, you know, all, huge ovation and all that stuff, and strikes out. And but that, I think the narrative on his rookie season is kind of slanted because it was actually pretty good. I mean, he had a 93 OPS plus, which is pretty close to about average. And considering the way he had started, you know, he really recovered pretty well. And then, you know, he was at 109 OPS plus in 2008. And over those 2 years was very, very easily and at least an average player. And then in 2009, he tore the labrum in his hip and needed surgery, missed, you know, pretty much half the year. It was pretty much a lost year. In 2010, you know, he broke his thumb early in spring training and really wasn't in any of the workouts or spring training games, and you know, started out kind of slow, and they ended up sending him to Omaha, and you know, the rest, you know, he went, played outfield, he made Triple A All-Star team, he came back, he really didn't hit very great in 2010 once he came back to the big leagues, but he did in 2011 and 2012, and reasonably in 2013, though the second half he was really rough. But you know, in general, yeah, I mean, even in his worst years in that 2009-2010, Alex Gordon was a lot better than what Mike Moustakas has been.
Yeah, so the evidence is there if you want to send him down. Like, nobody's going to fault the Royals, which is so perplexing because they're fighting it so hard sending him down as if, you know, there's something bad about it. And there's, you know, there's the obvious from the front office's standpoint, you know, we don't want to admit we're wrong. We don't want to mess with Mike Moustakas' confidence, maybe, I don't know. But, you know, it seems like they're only fighting themselves with this, because if you ask anybody else in baseball and you just show them a stat line that's Mike Moustakas's, they'd probably say, why don't you send that guy to AAA? You know, if you ask anybody in the fan base, that's what they're going to say. I mean, he's barely, his OPS is 436. Like, what in the world? This guy's an everyday Major League Baseball player. He's played 33 of the 37 games for the Royals. He's had 121 plate appearances, and this is what we're looking at. And he's got his career high walk rate so far. I mean, he's walking at a much better clip than he ever has in his career, even going down to the minors, really. So, like I said, it's the reasons are compelling and they're there. And to give kind of a counterpoint to it, there's what the front office is fighting with. Okay, number one, the biggest thing that everyone always worries about, that I go back and forth on this, and we'll get your thoughts on this, Mike, because I'm curious what you think. But number one is going to be the confidence factor, right? Where especially young players, you know, in that kind of 25 and under range that have never had to do the bounce back and forth between majors and AAA, you wonder, is it going to destroy this guy's confidence? Because you got to imagine, you know, going into your job and saying, it's basically, you know, say you're a manager and the president of your company or whatever says, hey, come into my office. It's just not working out. Maybe someday you can be a manager again, but right now we're bumping you down to staff level. You know, I mean, that's a horrible feeling. It's got to be. So it's understandable why you would worry about that. Mm-hmm. But in the same respect, you know, he's a professional and you're a professional. And, you know, if I or somebody else was in that position, you would expect to take it in stride and say, okay, you know, maybe I screwed up, whatever the case may be. I'm going to work harder to get back to that point where I was, where you had faith in me to be a manager. Well, that's where I go back and forth, because I want to say, you know, he is a professional baseball player. He knows it's a possibility that he could get demoted. You know, it's much less of a possibility for that typically to happen in the work world, the workforce. But, you know, when you're in baseball, you know that's a possibility if you don't succeed. And that's typically a result if you don't succeed. So I think, you know, it's you should be worried about his confidence, because you want him to be confident. But in the same respect, you know, he needs to have the results. And if they're not there, he needs to reap the consequences of him not playing, because whatever he's doing, he's not doing it right, and he needs to fix it. So that's usually the side that I lean, but I do understand that confidence and understanding the player is an aspect of it. I mean, where do you come out on this? Do you err more towards the side of let's make sure that, you know, he's okay mentally, that he can handle what's ahead of him? Or are you the professional ball player, this is a reality type of standpoint?
Well, I mean, it should be something where his reaction is, if it does happen that he gets demoted and optioned to AAA, I mean, it should be that his reaction is, okay, this is the wake-up call. This is where, you know, I've got to go really redouble my efforts here and get back in a groove and really find what's going to work for me and then bring it back to the big league level. I mean, that's what he should, what the reaction should be, but it's easily possible for it to be something where, you know, like the analogy of, okay, you know, you're called into the office. Well, a lot of times people will just, you know, they'll sneak into it. And, you know, if you give them that demotion, you never see them back up again. They can either be bitter, they can have their confidence completely shot because, you know, they tried to play up at a higher level and couldn't do it. And, you know, then you get all those different doubts and frustrations and everything. So, you know, I think that's kind of one of the problems the Royals really had to face, was dealing with the timing of this, because they gave him 100 at bats, you know, 100 some plate appearances to try to give him a chance to break out and, you know, work on the gains that he'd made in Venezuela and, you know, all the adjustments that they talked about during spring training. And the guy went and got married, you know, so it seemed like all these different things were lined up that, okay, you know, he doesn't have to worry about this, this, and this, and he can just go out and build off of what he's worked on. And he comes right out of the gate and struggles, and it's just the same song and dance as every other year. There's a certain point where they do have to say, you know, we just can't do this anymore, and you have to make a move, and you can't really sit there and try to ride it out anymore. I think we're at that point, because it's at this stage, you know, the Royals in a lot of ways are basically a 500 team in spite of their offense, and Moustakas is the biggest anchor on that offense right now. And if they can make a change, even to get a short-term boost at third base, you know, the side effect is that, okay, maybe he does go down to Omaha, rediscover what worked for him, and is able in a month to bring that back. And, you know, is the guy that you kind of expected, the 25 homer guy who can hit, you know, maybe he only hits 250, or at least, you know, once he comes back, you know, I think he's probably got to hit 400 the rest of the year if he's going to end up at 250. But, you know, if he can do that from a recall on to the end of the year, well, then that's okay. I mean, then you get something out of him from, you know, for most of the second half, and you get to that point where it works. The flip side is that, you know, he never really gets it. You know, something that is supposed to inspire more confidence turns into him having the same struggles in Omaha, which just makes it even worse. And then you run into a bigger problem where, okay, now what? Because he's entering arbitration years. And you kind of have to look at, okay, Hunter Dozier's not ready yet. Chesler Cuthbert's probably not ready yet. What do you do? And then you kind of have to start looking at, you know, change of scenery trade. Do you do some kind of, you know, 2-year signing for free agency? Or do you try to do it again next year where you rely on him? I mean, that's a lot in the future. And a lot of it depends on, A, what the Royals do, and B, how Moustakas reacts. But I... For him, I get my hunch And this is just based on kind of watching him on the field and seeing how he's reacted and kind of understanding some of his hesitance to go towards video and other, you know, ways to get help. It kind of feels like he needs to get down there and find something. And, you know, if it shoots his confidence down to be sent down, there's not much you can do about that. I mean, if that's just the player he is, where that wrecks him, I don't know what you can say. You know, I mean, it's his job to be better than this, and he hasn't been better. So, you know, he does have to kind of get by it and do what he has to do, either at the big league level or at AAA, and we'll find out tomorrow which one that ends up being. So, you know, that's definitely something to watch for. I think of those scenarios, it's most likely he's going to get sent down, because they can get better production, even bad production, out of Danny Valencia and Johnny Giovitella, and, you know, continue on with the rest of the offense doing what they've been doing. So, you know, we'll have
to see. I mean, right now, Giovitella, he's only played 4 games and 16 plate appearances, and we're talking incredibly small sample size, but let's just look at it. Yes, that'll be important here in a future segment of the show. But, I mean, let's just look at his line and say, okay, he's hitting .214 with a .250 on base and a .429 slugging percentage, which none of that, I mean, .429 slugging is decent, but, you know, when you put it all together, that makes him have a, you know, a .679 OPS, nothing special with that, and actually stuff that's very not special. But point being, if you extrapolate that for an entire season, you're getting much more production from Johnny Giovitella than you would from Moose hitting .147 and whatever else the rest of his line is. You know, so from that standpoint, you know, it's definitely, you can't do much worse, which, right, again, that's a bad bar to set so low, but at the same time, it's the reality. And that kind of brings me to the next one, the next factor of the Moustakas decision. One of the things that, if the Royals don't send him down, this is one of the things they're going to say, and they've said it before too, as a reason not to send him down. And it's going to be, we think he can hit minor league pitching, and he's not going to get any better going up against that. And this one, I guess it's situational, but in this case, for me, I don't buy into that, because I don't think Mike Moustakas's problem is necessarily hitting major league pitching. He's proved for 2011, when he came up, and the first half of 2012, that he can hit major league pitching. This is not something that he is completely incapable of doing. He's had, you know, in his career, multiple prolonged stretches where he has been and, you know, even above average major league hitter. And when you take that into consideration, then it's kind of like, okay, well, it's not an ability standpoint. And I don't think anybody's ever thought that it was an ability standpoint, but when you use that excuse of, oh, we want him to try and work against major league pitching. Well, when he's shown that ability and then it just kind of falls out, and he's always been kind of a streaky guy, I think typically that lends to more of a mechanical issue and something with his approach, something with his mechanics, something that's a physical thing that can be corrected. So if he goes down to AAA, he's going to mash even if he has bad mechanics, just because he's that uber talented, mm-hmm, from a, you know, just everybody standpoint. But to be at the major league level, you know, he has to have a more refined approach. And when Hosmer came up, he hit some pretty low lows in his career as well, but he's adjusted, he's changed his approach, and he's reaping the benefits now. He's having a pretty good season so far. Well, Moose has tried has not worked. So that's why I think that argument is invalid in this case, because you can send him down. It doesn't matter if he mashes or not. You need to say, okay, this is what you need to work on. We want to see you change your approach this way, because when you've got the pressure of the major leagues and when you're going up against even better hitting, it's hard to work on a mechanical issue or an approach issue, mm-hmm, and see how much better it works when you're going up against Hisashi Iwakuma, who I don't care how good your mechanics are, the dude is gonna light you up either way, most likely. And that's how it's gone so far for him. So I mean, he needs to be in a position where he can work on those things in a more conducive atmosphere, which is why I don't think that argument really flies for me.
Yeah, I think that makes sense, because if he gets sent down, it's going to be a process versus results kind of thing. Like, I mean, I think they'd love to see him go down there, hit 400 and mash, you know, 8 homers in a month. That'd be great. But it just as important the way that he does it. I mean, if he does it with the same mechanics, and it's, you know, I think Aaron Reese from the Triple Play podcast has kind of noted this on Twitter, that it seems like his stance changes every time up. And that was one of the things in the offseason that he really changed, where he went to a wide open stance and it worked in spring training, but it seems like once the season started, he hasn't been consistent with it. And so if he can do that consistently and be a consistent guy mechanically in the minors and goes down there and mashes, then that's something that the Royals are going to be looking, you know, to really kind of decide when they might bring him back up, hypothetically, if he gets sent down. You know, or you can try to make that adjustment at the big league level, but at the big league level, you're really, I mean, every game really makes a difference. Whereas in the minor leagues, I mean, it's great that Omaha can win the PCL every year, but, you know, those flags don't fly at Kauffman. So, you know, it doesn't really make that big of a difference. And honestly, I mean, I couldn't even tell you who they beat any of the last couple of years. And so, because wins at the minor league level really don't make a big difference. I mean, they will tear apart a minor league roster if you need those players in the big leagues in September. And, you know, so the wins don't matter that much other than to the fan base in the minor leagues. So that's all you're kind of looking for is how those wins come about, how the good hits, how the production comes about, especially when you're looking at a guy, you know, who you expect to be your everyday third baseman, you know, number 5, number 6 hitter, guy who can hit for power, number 2 overall prospect, or no, he was 3. No, he was 2. He was 2. He was number 2 overall in 07. You know, that's a guy that you've got to get him right. And if a trip to Omaha is what it takes, they got to do it. And it's probably far too late for it already. I mean, this is something that 50 at-bats they probably could have done. But, you know, I can understand they wanted to ride it out and see if he could turn it around. But, you know, it's time, I think, at this point. So we'll see tomorrow. Yeah,
and just to kind of add to, you know, in the second half of 2011 for Moustakas, he had 64 games, 246 at-bats, 262 plate appearances. He hit .276. And then you combine that with the first half of 2012, which was 79 games, 327 plate appearances. He hit .268. So you're looking at a .270 hitter and 15 home runs in 2012 in that the first half of the season. And then 4 home runs in the second half of 2011. So you're looking at a .270 hitter with 19 home runs in what is effectively a full season. You know, so I mean, just to give credence to the fact that he can hit major league pitching for an extended period of time, I don't think that's the issue. I think there's something else, and that's why it can be successful. But with that, I think we're going to take our first break. And something we've hit on, kind of a couple buzzwords. You've heard Michael Engel do his excellent ding impression. So with that, we're going to come back and we're going to talk about, as we near that 40-game point, the sample size and how big is big enough for a sample size. So we'll talk about that when we come back, and we'll see you on the other side.
Kelly's Westport Inn has been a Kansas City tradition for generations. But now, you can be part of a new tradition brought to you by Kelly's and the friendly neighbors at McCoy's. On Sunday, May 25th, come on out to the 3rd annual Kelly's and McCoy's Block Party. Bring a friend, meet new friends. You can dance by yourself. We don't care. It's whatever makes you happy. There's just a $5 cover charge to get into the best outdoor party in Westport, and the fun starts at 8 p.m. Come out and enjoy the warm spring air and the best entertainment district the city has to offer. And while you're sipping on a refreshing beverage, in moderation, of course, enjoy the sounds of Lost Wax, who take the stage at 9:30 and will be playing long into the night. I mean, you're off on Memorial Day already, right? It's everything you could want. Great weather, great atmosphere, and the great people of Kansas City. And even better, you've got Lost Wax playing all your favorite tunes. That's on May 25th, starting at 8 p.m., the third annual Kelly's and McCoy's Block Party.
Welcome back into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. On that last break you heard there, that was a little sound clip from Lost Wax, who will be at the Kelly's Block Party on May 25th. Block Party starts at 8. Lost Wax takes the stage at 9:30, and they will play all night long, ladies and gentlemen. Cool band, great people. It's going to be a great time. You should get out there May 25th. Kelly's Westport Inn in Westport, of course. The Hoppin' Westport. But as I teased before we went to break, now we're going to talk about sample size. This is something that, you know, it's kind of creeped into normal lexicon here, but it's something that started in the kind with the kind of sabermetric movement where it's more or less a statistical, not something that's exclusive to baseball is what I mean, but it's a statistical methodology, more or less, whereby, you know, the larger the sample size, the more accurate your data. So when you say small sample size, it's, you know, if you look at it this way, theoretically, if you flip a coin, right, you have a quarter and you flip it, you got a 50-50 chance it's heads or tails. Well, you can flip it five times in a row and you might get heads each time, but so you're looking at 100% heads, 0% tails. But if you flip it 100 times, more often than not, it's going to come out pretty close to 50-50. It's not going to be exact. You might get 52 heads and 48 tails or whatever the case may be. But, you know, statistically, and it's been proven that more or less it's going to come out to be pretty close to 50-50. Point being, the larger population you have to draw from, the more accurate your data is going to be. Well, what about baseball though? Like, with there's so many variables, so many different things. There's at bats, there's plate appearances, there's pitches, there's innings, there's games, all these different denominations of time spent and played. How do you accurately mark it off? Where do you get to where you can finally say, okay, it's not a small sample size. The data we have here, we can rely on this. You know, we can say this player is probably going to have a good season, or this player is struggling and it's going to take a lot to get them to come back. So that's kind of our in-depth topic this week that we're really going to look into. And Mike went and did a lot of research on this, and, you know, he kind of found some interesting things. Mike, why don't you run down what everything you found out about, you know, sample size and the different methodologies that are out there.
It's very math heavy, and I'm leaning quite a lot on the work of others because I'm not a mathematician. I don't play one on TV. I didn't stay in a Holiday Inn Express last night. None of that. I was a history major, so, I mean, this is not my thing. But in the context of baseball, I mean, there's a lot of good work out there, and a lot of guys are doing a lot of really interesting stuff. And we'll have these links on royalspodcast.com. as well, so that you can take a look at them as well. But the general idea in the methodology behind coming up with, you know, where something is a reasonable sample size comes from comparing information about a player to other samples of that player's performance. And so basically you're taking two sets of data from that pool of that player's performance, comparing it to see how reliable it is against itself. And so for each stat, plate appearances, you know, you're looking at, you know, what rates they're hitting you know, singles or walks and things like that. You know, at what point does that reliability kind of reach the threshold that you want it to be, where you regard it as a reliable set of data? And, you know, the general kind of idea is that it'll cross, you know, these data points will cross at like a 0.7 reliability factor, which is basically just saying that, okay, this is accepted statistically as reliable data. And so what the work that these guys have done at Baseball Prospectus and Hardball Times really kind of points to certain thresholds where you can really kind of expect the data to regress to what typical performance is going to be. And so when we're talking small sample size, you know, you're talking, okay, somebody could be overperforming their regular level of production. They could be underperforming. It goes back to that first point you made about a larger sample of data provides a more accurate portrayal of what that player or what that performance is. So in this case, I mean, just take two pitchers, for example. A guy like Jason Vargas, for instance, has come out his first 8 starts of the year. You know, he's a 3.04 ERA guy. He's, you know, having a really good season. But he's also got years and years and years of information as a starting pitcher at the major league level that tell you that he's very average. You know, he's pretty much right there as the most average pitcher you could find.
Average, he is the poster boy for average. That is for sure.
I mean, the best way to describe him is just milk toast. He is just, he is a faceless pitcher. I mean, he is the average guy. I mean, he just is.
A faceless pitcher who is $32 million richer, but that's beside the point.
Right. You just put him out there, and he's just going to give you average production historically. So you look at that 3.04, and you would expect that to regress towards what his career rates have typically been. And so, you know, in this case, I would say that his 53.1 innings, while very good, have been a small sample size, and the rest of the season will probably be more towards that production that you're used to. Now, that doesn't mean that he's going to be so bad that his numbers turn out to be completely average over the course of the year, because the 53.1 innings he's thrown still count. I mean, they still count, but I would say that from now until his next 24 starts or whatever, he's probably going to be a pretty average guy. And you compare that to somebody like Yordano Ventura, who has, 10 career starts now. We don't really know exactly what he can do at the major league level, because he's really coming into his own, where he's getting all three of his pitches refined to where he has good command. And even in his bad performances, they're really not that bad. So a guy like that, you're not sure. I mean, yeah, he's got a 2.34 ERA, and I would bet most rookie pitchers aren't going to continue at that level. But we don't know, because we don't have this track record of major league pitching to say that, okay, you know, he's more likely to slide back towards 3.5 or 4 or whatever. He definitely could. You know, it's no guarantee that says, okay, he's been really good, he's going to continue this way, but there's nothing that says he's not. Because
he's establishing that track record that we can look at 5 years from now.
Right, right. And so, I mean, and that's not to say that, okay, Ventura's, you know, the sky's the limit. I mean, it is. But we don't know that. And so when you compare pitchers in that kind of regard, you're looking at, you know, what they've done versus anything else. If you look at, like, James Shields, if he had started out his first 8, you know, if he had started out like Jeremy Guthrie has started out, where, you know, given up a lot of homers, a high ERA, you know, not really striking out a lot of guys, you would say, okay, based on what he's done, and he's got, you know, year after year of 200 plus innings, a really reliable set of data, you could say, well, he's probably going to be just as he was in the past, unless there's other circumstances. And, you know, statistically is one way to kind of look at it. And it's always kind of a moving target, because there's always, what they found in this research is that there are different thresholds for different kind of aspects. And so you could have a guy who starts in his first 4 games of the year, really doesn't strike a lot of guys out, but can really make it up by a couple of 10 strikeout games. And so that stat, the strikeout rate, will stabilize a lot faster than something like the batting average on balls in play, because you just need a larger sample for it to really level out and regress back to that mean level of production, which is just a really mathematical and statistical way of saying it really depends in a lot of cases. Kind of shifting from just statistical, I mean, it's pretty obvious to just say, okay.
Just really quick, sorry, I just wanted to say that I think that's the most interesting thing from everything that you found that you brought up, is that, you know, we preach this small sample size and talk about it, but it's not a hard and fast rule for every part of a player's game. Mm-hmm. You know, there are different factors that play into different aspects, like, you know, how many strikeouts they get per game and how quickly that stabilizes versus other areas, which is something that, you know, even someone, you know, myself, who I'm really into the stats and I read a lot about it, you know, I had never really, you know, thought about it that way and kind of put that together. So that's just a bit of an interesting wrinkle to throw into it that I thought was really good from the stuff that you found.
Yeah. And so it's difficult to really nail down exactly what is a small sample size. But I mean, a good example of things where you kind of see these things leveling out quickly is Nori Aoki, who started the year out striking out, you know, through the first month, he was striking out at about 18% of the time, which compared to how he had done in the majors up to that point, you know, in 2012, he struck out 9.4% of the time. Last year with the Brewers, he struck out 5.9% of the time. So, I mean, that's your baseline. That's kind of what you're looking at as far as, okay, this is a guy who very, very rarely strikes out, especially relative to the league. And so that 18% was drastically higher than what you would have expected. But, you know, at a certain point, that leveled out quickly to where now, you know, he struck out maybe two or three times in the last couple weeks, which has really lowered his overall strikeout rate to 13.3%. So it's going to be a lot closer to what his career numbers have been as a strikeout rate, you know, than, you know, based on kind of what he's done this year and in the last couple weeks, because that normalizes faster. Another example of how it might take a little longer is Eric Hosmer in 2012, because he started out with just a horrid, horrid record on balls in play. And through the first 6 weeks of the season, no matter how hard he was hitting, it seemed like he was finding the fielder every single time. And when you kind of look at, you know, how he did over the course of the year, you know, he did level out a little bit, but he still was never able to really get his batting average on balls in play back up, because the correction takes such a larger length of time and a larger number of instances to level out. And so, you know, when you talk about batting average on balls in play, you could say, okay, it's a small sample size, but at the same time, you know, it does take a larger sample for that to turn. Typically, you'll say over the course of a year, it's going to be at 30%, but that doesn't mean that because someone's at 25%, it's going to be at 30% at the end of the year. Maybe from that point, it can be at 30% and they finish up at 28% of their hits, their balls in play go for hits.
And an interesting way of looking at this is, you know, a lot of the things that we look at and you talk about, especially when dealing with advanced statistics, is stuff that has, you know, more or less it's been there for a long time. It's just a question of how and why people utilize it. And I think this is more or less something similar, where it sounds really mathematical and complex, and it is. But at the same time, you know, pretty much everybody who's played baseball has really thought about it this way. You probably just don't know it. Like, if you talk, like, your point that you just made, talking about, you know, batting average on balls in play and needing a larger sample size, kind of got me thinking along that path where you say, you know, how many times have, whether you're playing little league ball, high school, college, you know, talking about people in the pros, whatever, you know, oh, it's just a slump, you know, they'll come out of it. Well, a slump, quote unquote, is quite simply an easily understood way to convey this idea that we're talking about of statistical sampling. And, you know, the reason that you can so easily say, especially for someone like, say, Billy Butler, The reason you can so easily say, oh, well, he's just in a slump right now or in a funk or whatever, he's going to come out of it, is because of that sample size argument, where you know that if someone, you know, if Billy Butler's hitting 242 and he's a 298 career hitter, well, it's going to trend towards that way because the body of work he has that says he's a 298 hitter is greater and more predictive than the body of work that says he's a 242 hitter. You know, not the again, like you just said, not to say that it's impossible that he would go an entire season that would bat for 242, and it's probably most likely that he's not going to hit 298 this season either. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the rest of the way from here, would I be surprised if he hit 298, 310, and he ends up in the 285 range? Not at all, because that's the prediction that we have from the reliable data that we have. And, you know, it's more or less usually skews toward that. So, I mean, that's kind of an interesting, when you think about it, that, hey, you know, I mean, everybody's more or less used this idea of statistical sampling. It's just never really called that, or really, you know, you don't sit there in the dugout at a Little League game and delve into the statistical methods of, you know, why little Johnny is going to come out next week, come out of his slump next week. So this is kind of an interesting way of thinking about it that makes it a little bit more understandable than, you know, what some of the statistical models are going to look like on
right.
paper.
Yeah, because, I mean, they were throwing out, I mean, like I said, not a math guy, but they were throwing out names that sounded like, I mean, they sounded like, I don't know, election results, or they sounded like, you know, prize fights. It's like, okay, a bunch of names attached to these studies, and I'm like, I don't know what they're talking about in that sense. But the concept is really pretty simple when it gets down to it, because it's just like you said, it's something you kind of do automatically, where you think, okay, you know, I know that I've seen this guy perform over, you know, the course of his career. I understand that he's probably going to be able to be, you know, good. You know, it's just a slump, or, well, he hasn't been hitting yet, but I know it's going to happen, or something like that. And it's kind of something you do automatically. And I think it's important to point out that when you're talking about sample sizes and regression, you do have to put some common sense behind it, because it's, you know, just as much as the stats kind of validate the idea of these kind of thresholds and that there is regression and that it's pretty reliable to look at it from that kind of point of view, you also have to look at everything else. Like, did a guy change leagues? Like Nori Aoki, you know, he changed leagues, his strikeout rate goes up, and he's facing guys he hasn't faced before. Plus, they're, you know, Max Scherzer and Justin Verlander and Ubaldo Jimenez and strikeout guys. So, yeah, I mean, it's reasonable to say that his strikeout rate under those circumstances is going to go up. You could also observe by, you know, Eric Hosmer in 2012. Okay, well, his BABIP was pretty bad, but he was also swinging at bad pitches. And so you can kind of be like, okay, well, he hasn't really swung at anything good all year. So, yeah, maybe his BABIP's low, but there's a reason why it's low. So there's a lot of just things that you also have to take in those things. And I think that's important in any kind of baseball analysis or baseball thought, is that you do have to take in all those circumstances. You have to take in age. I mean, when you look at projections like the Zips projections and Bill James and Sierra projections and all the different projection models that come out before the season starts, they're all based off of this idea that players at this age level perform at this level. And so you have to kind of weight it against that. And a lot of them, they will weight more recent seasons. Like, for instance, they'll weight Billy Butler's 2013 more than his 2012, because 2013 is closer to what he's done. And so their projection is going to look more like 2013 than 2012. And as a result, you know, he's older. His recent performance was worse. And so you would expect it to be closer to that than his big year of 2012. And that makes sense. I mean, it just seems like that makes logical sense if you're looking at statistically, or if you're just looking at it, you know, in a box score or just kind of glancing at it. It seems like, okay, he's trending this way. You expect him to kind of continue in that sense. Go ahead.
Well, I think you brought up a really important point of context. You know, I think we get on the show a lot, and we talk about stats, you know, especially, you know, last couple of weeks when we started doing these more in-depth topics, we throw a lot of numbers out, a lot of stats, and there's, you know, we've always kind of talked about this dynamic, you know, whether it's on Twitter, whether it's, you know, on the blogs, whether it's you arguing with your friend or whatever, talking about advanced statistics versus, you know, the Ned Yost kind of guttural baseball instinct and feeling and that kind of stuff. And I think that what you hit on in one of your points that I thought was it just, you know, it's, there are lots of factors, you know, more than just the sample size. You know, you have to look at what kind of pitches is Eric Hosmer swinging at in 2012 and things like that. So, I mean, it's all just numbers on a page until you take in the context of the action. And I think that's why sometimes, you know, we'll come on here and you see, you know, we'll, you know, complain about something or point out a flaw in an argument from Dayton Moore or from Ned Yost or something like that. And all things considered, maybe those particular instances, whether it's a play on the field or whether it's a call management or a front office move, maybe that particular instance might not necessarily be horrible, but taken in the context of everything, then it looks a little different. So, you know, not to get lost on the whole sample size thing, that the context is definitely very important, because you kind of need that to be able to assess, okay, here's the data. Now, how do we take that, apply it, and then go from here?
Yeah. And with, you know, if you're looking at it from a team standpoint, I mean, right now you have an idea what these guys are. I mean, you know, Omar Infante has been in the league a long time. You know, he's not going to suddenly hit 30 home runs for you. You know that Alcides Escobar is probably not going to hit 350. You know, you just know these things because they haven't really done that. So you have an idea today how this team's probably going to perform from their lineup, from their pitching, you know, to the rest of the year. You have an idea. I mean, I think the offense will probably improve because I think Butler will be better. I think Gordon will be better, largely because their performance in the past suggests they would be better than this. And so you kind of get that kind of built into it. That also being said, I mean, maybe they, you know, Vargas regresses a bit. Maybe Ventura kind of levels out to what he's, you know, he's maybe not going to be a Cy Young guy. So, I, you know, there's a lot of different factors. A lot of them are moving all the time. But I think if you look at a sample size now, I think, you know, 40 games, it's pretty fair to sit here and say, okay, you know, I have an idea. There's still room for some of these guys to really take off. I mean, Eric Hosmer could, you know, look at this last week on the road trip. He hit about 500 and had a really good series in San Diego and in Seattle. And, you know, any of these players could go on a tear like that just as quickly, just the same as like Sal Perez had that 0 for 20 spot and ended up really kind of having to come back out of that. And he's still kind of working out of that. So,
and it's, in many ways, it's maybe from a statistical standpoint and from an analysis standpoint, maybe the biggest advantage that you have as a front office in baseball. Because, and when I say in baseball, I mean versus football or versus basketball or hockey, because the statistics and the predictive value of those statistics is so much greater in baseball than it is in any of the other sports. Because, number one, baseball is the least team sport of all the sports. And so when you think about football, right, and you know, your average quarterback in the NFL these days is probably going to have as many pass attempts as plate appearances for a baseball player. So then you would, you know, an everyday player. So you would think, well, okay, then the completion percentage for a quarterback would be just as predictive as a batting average. It doesn't quite work that way because, well, every time a quarterback goes back to pass, he's got five guys in front of him that are blocking five guys on the other side. You've got, you know, receivers that are running different routes and all these things. And there's just so many different variables that go into that one play every single time. Whereas when you're in, you know, in baseball, I mean, there are definitely variables like, you know, what kind of pitch it is and the shift of the defense, but it's so much to a lesser extent. And it gives you an advantage because it's so much within each individual player's control, you know, their abilities, that those statistics have that much more value. So that's why I think it's such a big deal in baseball more so than the other sports, and why it's something that's kind of caught on. And that's why sometimes when we get on here and we talk about the Royals front office and not valuing OBP and not looking at, you know, the pitcher splits for right-handers versus left-handers and all those different things that we complain about, you know, that's why, because baseball more than any other, it does have predictive value. You can gauge decisions based on these things because more often than not, it will work. Now, the problem is you have to be consistent because there are times where you're going to trot out there and you're going to make the right decision. And Joe Posnanski wrote this in his article, one of the ones that we, I can't remember which one it was, one of the ones recently that we talked about, but, you know, or oh, it was the intentional walk hate meter.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, in baseball, there are many times where you make the right decision and it doesn't work, and you make the wrong decision and it does work. So in order for it to actually have value over the course of the season, you have to be consistent. And that's part of the problem with the Royals right now, in the last two decades, is that Nen Yost and Dayton Moore really haven't been consistent in what they, with their approach and what they value and what they want their players to value in their approach. And so, you know, if it seems like, I think sometimes we kind of get accused, and, you know, we have been on this show before, but even beyond that, just whether it's on Twitter or in blogs or whatever, of kind of just blindly following these stats and looking at all that. Well, you know, it's not blindly following because we do take context into account, but also, you know, there's a reason we look at them so much and we value them, because they have such great predictive value that you just can't get from any other sports. That's one of the things, one of the advantages that I think baseball has.
Yeah. I mean, as long as baseball's been around, they've been keeping stats. I mean, you know, back into the 19th century, they had scorecards and everything, and they might not have been as detailed as they are now. But, you know, it is something that, it does kind of work towards baseball's favor, because you have this large sample of data going back to 1880 where you can say, okay, this is what teams have generally done. And another thing, you know, the stat thing always takes a hit, because guys like to go out and say, well, this guy's hitting 350 on Wednesday afternoon games after Labor Day. It's like, no, you know, that the guys who really watch stats and like try to use stats to enhance how we observe the game won't do that, because going back to sample sizes, you're just narrowing down the sample at that point, so you're making it a less reliable pool of data. And that's why I think, you know, the Royals are really bad about this when they look at on their scoreboard at Kauffman, where they put up stats and they're like, they'll put up like lefties at home on weekends and stuff. They'll put those stats up just because you can make them look like, okay, well, Alcides Escobar's hitting 375 against lefties on Sunday afternoon games, you know, because they're not going to put, you know, last year Alcides Escobar was making an out 75% of the time.
Yeah. I mean, those are gimmicks, you know, and those are, I think the whole point of those is so that you keep the fans engaged, because you're looking at them and you say, oh,
yeah, here's
we better pay attention, because Escobar is going to go off on here because he's got a 370 versus left-handers in the, you know, month of July on Sunday afternoons when it's over 92 degrees outside. This is, you know,
he has 8 at-bats in that sample, probably.
Exactly. So
Nobody cares because they just see 375.
Exactly. So that's a little bit different. Those are more kind of just fun TV, keep the fans engaged stats. But yeah, true statistical analysis, you know, doesn't try to further pare down the stats. I mean, there's some things that you want to break off because it's necessary, you know, platoon splits, right, you know, how does somebody fare versus righties versus lefties? I mean, I guess you might be able to say there's some validity to the day game, night game thing, simply because
different situations, a
player's vision might be affected, but I mean, that's kind of a fringe one. But you know, the righty lefty thing is big, and different things like that. So there are points where you do want a segment because it provides additional value. But yeah, stuff like that where it's just situational. I mean, you can't really predict much from somebody who's had 10 at bats in a particular scenario.
Yeah. But I mean, going back to the kind of the original idea, and this was brought up by Jack, one of our listeners. He's asking, okay, when is it, you know, far enough into the year to say that okay, this isn't just a sample size. I think that, I mean, team wise, 40 games is a good idea, because you're definitely, you know, usually a couple months in, 6 weeks in, you have a slight idea. I mean, I think the Royals are closer to a 500 team probably, based on how they've done. And that's probably very close to how they'll continue in some regards. So, but again, I mean, it's all a moving target. It's all really fluid. It's tough to nail that down, but I think generally, you know, when you're talking from a team standpoint, 40, 50 games, you have an idea at that point. Okay. You can look at a team and be like, okay, they might have a shot, or they might need a really, really big turnaround to get this going. And right now the Royals, they really need a lot more offense, and they need to continue on defense and on the mound. And if they get that offensive push, then yeah, I mean, they can definitely do better over the next, you know, 120 games than they've done in the first 40 games. But you have to go back and look at everything and say, okay, well, maybe they're not going to.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, there's a lot of interesting stuff there, and especially when you talk about sample size, you know, it's important, especially around this time, because, you know, like you said, I think we're getting to that point where we can really start to see, and, you know, we said it before the season, I think a lot of us talked about the Royals probably close to a 500 team, maybe a little bit better, maybe a little not, you know, right? So, I mean, right now, that's about, the proof is in the pudding. That's kind of what we're seeing. And it's one of those things where it's probably going to be like this the rest of the season. So, you know, who knows? I mean, if the Royals can snap off 10 in a row or 15 out of 20, 16 out of 20, like they did last year, you know, maybe then they can kind of get back into this thing and make some noise. But, you know, to this point, they've kind of shown what we thought they would be. And looking at a lot of the players, you know, there's some, your Billy Butlers of the world, but I mean, there's a lot of, the evidence we have doesn't necessarily suggest a ton of change. So, you know, you kind of hope that there are some variables, but
yeah, I mean, Eric Hosmer's on pace for like 5 home runs. I mean, he's going to finish with more than 5 home runs.
Yes, absolutely.
Alex Gordon, Billy Butler, they'll finish with more than 5. I mean, they will.
And, you know, Mike Moustakas is on pace for, you know, 15, 20, and he probably won't have that many. So,
yeah,
you never know. But, so, yeah, with that, I think we're going to kind of wrap up. That was our in-depth topic for this week. I hope you enjoyed it. Again, if you have any more suggestions, like this one came, like Mike said, from Jack. So if you have any other suggestions, you know, go ahead, feel free to write us, contact us on Twitter, you know, however you can get a hold of us. Which, by the way, Twitter is Michael Engel is at Michael Engel. I am at the Jeff Report on Twitter. So follow us, tweet at us, tell us how stupid we are, tell us what kind of different topics we should do. It wouldn't be the first time we've heard any of it, and we might even take it to the show. So I think we're going to leave you with that. Don't forget, Kelly's Westport Inn Block Party, May 25th, 8 o'clock, Lost Wax, the band. Well, you heard a clip of them earlier in the break. They'll be on stage at 9:30 that night. So May 25th, Kelly's Westport Inn Block Party, should be a good time. You guys should all definitely go out there. And Mike, you've got a, in the meantime, before our next show, probably, I think you might be tacking it on to this one, actually. You're going to have an interview for us. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm going to be talking to Brett Parker, who we talked to him a couple months ago, or I talked to him a couple months ago. He's the guy who came up with the idea for Dress to the Nines last year, which was a pretty big success. I mean, ended up on front page of Yahoo Sports, and a lot of national columnists kind of really noticed it, and the Royals ended up adopting it into their promotional schedule. That's going to be May 18th at the 1 p.m. game. So, I mean, I'm going to talk to him kind of about where they are in the planning and some of the things that are going on. There's a lot of Kansas City businesses that are involved in different fundraising aspects for pretty much most of it just goes to the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum and Bob Kendrick, because it's the 18th is going to be Salute to the Negro Leagues Day. It's Dress to the Nines Day. There is special seating at royals.com/NLBM. You know, it's really a pretty cool event, and he's going to tell a lot about it.
The giveaway is a Royals Monarch fedora.
Yeah.
Or I'm not Royals, sorry, Kansas City Monarchs fedora. So that'll be pretty cool.
So there you go.
Yeah, so be on the lookout for that. At the end of this show, Mike talking with Brett Parker, Dress to the Nines, and it's a really, really great event, really good game. Everybody should go out there. Obviously, you should go out to any Royals game you can, but that one specifically should be a lot of fun. Negro League Night, those are always good times. So with that, we'll leave you for the week. This has been a Kansas City Baseball Vault brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. For Michael Engel, myself, and the absent Troy Olson, I will see you. We will see you next week. And as always, go Royals.
And this is Michael Engel on the Kansas City Baseball Vault. As promised, we are going to be talking right now with Brett Parker. And we talked to him not too long ago, just a couple months ago, about Dress to the Nines. And that's coming up on the 18th of May, 1 p.m. game. So I just want to bring him in to kind of update everybody on all the things that are going on throughout Kansas City and the day of the game and everything else, so you can take full advantage of a really, really cool event. So first of all, Brett, I mean, we're at pretty much the home stretch now, but I mean, are you guys still putting some elements of this together to kind of some last minute additions to the whole event of Dress to the Nines?
Yeah, there's a couple of things still coming together. It's strange to think about last year at this time. We were still kind of pitching the whole idea and putting it together, and right now it feels like we're last minute at this point. Last year we were way out and just a day or two into planning. But the one thing that we are, fingers crossed, optimistic we'll be able to work out with the Royals and some of their sponsor deals, is a pregame tailgate. And if anyone's ever been to the game, if you come in through the at the left field entrance, there's some big tented areas out back behind there. And we're optimistic about having a tailgate out there, sponsored by Boulevard Beer, Four Roses Bourbon. The great thing, if this works out, is it would be a place to go and do some of your pregame activities. But the Royals will let us reserve a couple hundred of the Monarchs fedoras. So no matter what time you go into the game from there, you would have your fedora. So fingers crossed we'll be able to hammer out the final details on that with the team. One of the other exciting things is that Bob Kendrick and the Negro Leagues Museum has about five or six former players who either played in the Negro Leagues or have ties to the Negro Leagues who will be signing autographs at the game that day. And if we can make the tailgate work, then they'll be there. And otherwise, they'll just be at the stadium signing autographs in some capacity. And also out at the museum, I believe, on the 17th, they're kicking off a new exhibit at the museum. So if you can't make it out to a game and you want to have a chance to shake the hands of some guys who played in the Negro League, that'd definitely be a place to go. So the tailgate is kind of our last, hopefully, finishing touch on our preparations here as we get down to it.
So just to review, I mean, the idea behind this is that, you know, back in the 30s and 40s and in the heyday of the Negro Leagues, the you know, especially in Kansas City, church service would get out, and a lot of times they would schedule it earlier so that you could leave immediately from church and head to the Monarchs game, and that's kind of the spirit of this, which is really cool. You know, do you have any idea of turnout for this year so far? Is there any real easy way to guess? The Royals have been pretty aggressive in promoting this and putting it out there, but do you have any sense from them or from Bob about, you know, how much bigger this is going to be this year compared to last year?
Yeah, we're really anxious to see how this all turns out. If it's any indication, just the amount of people who the idea has come up with who've already said, oh yeah, I heard about that and I'm going to be out the game. That's been pretty staggering. I talked to Bob the other day and he was mentioning some guy saw him in line at Best Buy and recognized him and ran up and said, hey, I just want you to know I've got my tickets to Dress the Nines. I got my outfit picked out. So anecdotally, we're really excited about it. It's hard to track any specific numbers. We're hoping that as many people as possible who are planning to go out to the game have bought or will buy their tickets through the special link, the royals.com/NLBM, where the proceeds, parts of the proceeds of each ticket go back to the museum. But I think what will be really interesting with the great promotions that the Royals have done for it will just be kind of the range of effort that people put in. I think at this point, there's been enough saturation with the advertising and knowing that there's a fedora involved. I'm guessing you're going to see a lot of people who at least throw on a pair of slacks and like a button-down shirt and think, you know, we'll throw on the fedora at the end. But hopefully we'll get quite a few people out in the full-on suits and dresses and bringing their own hats and, you know, any other old-time accessories. Maybe we'll see some parasols out there.
And, you know, I mean, you mentioned Boulevard maybe a part of this and Four Roses and whatnot. But yeah, I've heard that the Julep has a new drink that they've invented basically for Dressed to the Nines. And also
yeah.
that Michael's is kind of helping out with a certain percentage off for, you know, anybody who goes in and mentions that they may be buying something specifically for Dress of the Nines or, you know, for whatever purpose.
Yeah, that's been one of the fun things this year as we've talked up the ideas to different people around town is just how many businesses are want to find a way to be connected. So Julep, which is a new whiskey bar in Westport, which if, you know, that's anyone's spirit of choice, they need to make their way over there. It's a great place. Literally, there is a wall of whiskey. So if that appeals to you, make plans to get over there. But they have a drink called the Monarch, which is perfect. And when we've talked to them about it, they said, you know what, it's this week, basically, so the week leading up to Dress the Nines, $2 of every Monarch will be donated to the museum. So if you needed an excuse to go, you know, have enjoy a nice whiskey cocktail, there it is, anytime between now and Sunday. And you don't have to mention the event, just any of them that they sell will be $2 towards the museum. And then Michael's clothing we're really excited about. And if anyone hasn't seen Michael's, it's been around for about 100 years off of Main, I think 19th Street in the Crossroads area. But they've got a great history in Kansas City, and they've jumped on board where anything that you buy there and mention that you're buying it for Dress the Nines Day, they'll put 15% towards the museum. And we're really excited to have them on as a partner just because of their history in Kansas City. And as Bob's talked about a couple of times, they throughout, you know, their early 1900s had a history of being a place that was very welcoming to the African-American community. So literally many fans who dressed to the nines for Monarchs games may have bought their suits or their hats at Michael's. And so that's just such a neat connection to be able to kind of continue on for this little tradition.
That's really pretty cool that you get to kind of connect back to not just, you know, dressing from that kind of era and following that tradition, but also, you know, if you chose to, you could go literally to a place where, you know, people would have been buying those items. That is a really cool aspect to all of this. I mean, did you ever really think that it would get this big? I mean, you guys got a lot of national attention last year, and the Royals approached you pretty soon after. But, I mean, this has been a pretty big thing, and this is, I imagine, a big part of you know, your winter and early spring activities, you know, outside of, you know, the regular day job and all that. I mean, how busy have you been and kind of how busy has Bob been through all of this?
Well, I'm not sure that Bob is ever anything but extremely busy. I think every time I catch him, he looks like he's just stepped out of, you know, about 10 straight meetings on different topics. But no, it's definitely taken up a lot of my time, and also Elizabeth and Brad, who have kind of co-founded the idea and participated, were a big part of pushing it last year. You know, lots of Saturday meetings at coffee shops and divvying up responsibilities and, okay, who's going to contact who and what are, you know, our plans for trying to grow things. You know, in a way, it's been like a small part-time job, but it's been a lot of fun to be involved with. I don't know that we had any vision for how big it has become this year or how big it might become. We're just kind of enjoying the process. It's such a simple and powerful idea that we just kind of like throwing it out there and watching people respond to it. So it'll be a lot of fun to see how many people come out for the game this year, how many are dressed up, and then, you know, what kind of attention that gets and where we might be able to springboard from here. I know looking into the future, we'd love to see other teams kind of jump on in the way that the Royals have this year and as a fan experience to complement the Salute to the Negro Leagues that a lot of teams do, you know, around the nation already. A way for the fans to come out and feel like they're being a part of recreating that experience as well. And ideally, you know, if they could do ticket packages like the Royals have been generous enough to do this year, where a portion of, you know, the special seats will go back to the museum. I mean, anything that we can do to kind of raise the profile of the museum and help them to expand on their legacy nationally would be fantastic. That's the long-term aim, is just all the attention and funds that we can get driven towards them, the better. So we're kind of excited to see, you know, what comes up from this year.
Yeah, I know that the museum is, I mean, so many players end up going there and so many different, you know, visiting dignitaries and just fans end up out there that, you know, anytime you can really push people there who haven't been there or raise the awareness, I mean, that, you know, every time I've been there, it's been a great experience. And, you know, I think an event like this where, you know, I went last year and am going to be there this year, I think it's going to be a lot of fun for everybody. But, you know, when you get it to go towards a really nice cause and a nice establishment like the museum, I think that makes it even better. Not just, you know, being a part of the organization of it, but for anybody who kind of participates, I mean, I would imagine a lot of the people who are going to be going are people who have been to the museum at least once or have run into, you know, Bob Kendrick or know Kansas City history. So, you know, it's great to hear the efforts that you guys have done and, you know, how the city's been involved as well. Are there any other businesses that have really jumped up, or is it kind of still, you know, kind of finishing touches on, you know, the Boulevard and everything else? Or are there other places that are kind of doing any other specials right now?
You know, we had discussions with a few, and I think there's interest. This just being the first year where it's really taken off and become more of an official thing. Unfortunately, we didn't have a structure, you know, ready to go that says, mm-hmm. Hey, here's how you're involved. So we're really excited that Julep just stepped up and, you know, they had their Monarch drink, which worked out so nicely with it anyway. But we do have a pretty good list of nicer restaurants that have expressed interest, and definitely next year when we get going with this again, hopefully we'll be able to get them on board. I know Anton's Tap House has expressed interest. They've helped us promote it a little bit on Twitter. Ryan Maybe, who owns and bartends Kill Devil Club and the Rieger and Manifesto, has been really supportive on social media. And if we are able to pull off our tailgate, he's mixing a bourbon punch with our Four Roses supply. And so they've been on board in a big way. And next year may be a little bit more too. We're kind of excited. We're kind of testing the waters of that involvement this year, and I think that could really take off next year. You know, hopefully you could spend the entire week eating out before, you know, Dress the Nines Day next year, supporting different places. So we'll hopefully have a long list of kind of Kansas City institution restaurants. But this year we're really excited about Julep getting on board and some of that interest that other places have expressed as well.
Well, I mean, all of this started with an idea. So to be at the point where you guys are at now, I mean, it's pretty impressive. It's a lot of fun. And I definitely encourage anybody who's listening to us. I mean, we try to talk about baseball history and Kansas City baseball history as much as we can. A lot of times it's usually about, you know, the current team. But, you know, when we get the opportunity, we want to kind of look back at those things. And this is a great way, you know, for any of our listeners in Kansas City to kind of jump on board with that, too. So, you know, again, May 18th, Dress to the Nines, show up in, you know, one of the first, is it 10,000 for the fedora?
10,000 fedoras, yeah.
Yeah. So be one of the first 10,000, show up in your suit, show up in a dress. You know, it's really easy to Google those styles if you really want to get really authentic and find vintage things. May 18th, 1 p.m. game, and go to royals.com/NLBM for the special ticket pricing. Again, for any other information, you can follow Brett at, you changed your handle to Brett to the Nines.
Yeah.
Since the last time we talked.
A little bit simpler.
Yeah. Pretty clever on that one. And is it Dressed to the Nines?
The official account is it's at To the Nines Day, and the nine is the numeral, at To the Nines Day.
Okay, so between when you're hearing this now and May 18th, any updates about Dress to the Nines Day can be found at both of those Twitter accounts, so I definitely urge you to follow both now. And, you know, considering, I think this is going to be a success. I think it's going to be something that the Royals will definitely want to continue. And so that, you know, we want to keep following both of those for any updates on next year's and beyond. So
Again, May 18th, Dressed to the Nines Day, show up at Kauffman in your Sunday best.
You have been listening to a Royals Podcast Network presentation.